Everybody, including you, including me, needs a little help. Even if you have trouble admitting it. You know, it doesn't matter how long you've been in sales. The more you learn, the more you earn. It's just that simple. And if your sales needs help, it may be time to consider the Gittimer Learning Academy. It's the fun and easy and gamified way to brush up on sales fundamentals and learn some new advanced strategies to close the next deal. You know, sales, closing, that's what it's all about. Or creating the atmosphere where the other person wants to buy. We have hundreds of hours of lessons on closing, referrals, prospecting, you name it. You won't find a more comprehensive library of sales knowledge anywhere on the planet that you can actually use 1 minute after you learn it. Go to GittimerLearningAcademy.com today and sign up for a free demo. I love free, and so will you. To me, that's the thing that pisses me off. Like, I don't want to...
One of the many things.
Well, if they ask a question, it's what's your vacation policy?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't... If you ask me about my vacation policy, what it tells me is you're going to be pissing and moaning if something happens that's not exactly right. I don't want that person here. Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sell or Die. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling and The Sales Manifesto.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute and author of the best-selling book, Sales in a New York Minute.
They're both the same title?
They are. I liked it so much, I named my company the same title as my best-selling book.
So nice. She named it twice.
I wonder what's going to happen when you get a car and a kid.
You know, it's not as bad as my parents naming me Jennifer after buying a book titled Names Beyond Jennifer and Jason.
Diehards, we have a show for you today. The great Jason, speaking of Jason.
Oh, yeah.
Jason Dorsey is here today to talk about generational gaffes, and problems, but he does present solutions. I mean, this guy's absolutely amazing. And
hands down, you're in for it. This may be my favorite episode of the year so far.
He gives insight with a capital I.
Oh, yeah. But before we get into the show, let's just talk about last night.
Okay.
All right.
And thanks for last night.
I wasn't going to go there, but last night we went to Laugh for the Cure to support the Susan G. Komen organization.
Breast cancer,
yeah. Because your daughter, Erica, is a breast cancer survivor.
Yep.
And we took anyone from the team that wanted to come. So it was a nice event.
And donate a few bucks.
Yep, for sure. And it was phenomenal.
It was a sellout crowd. I think we've only been going for a couple of years, but it sold out last year, it sold out this year. And they used as a draw for the second year comedians.
Yes, yes.
It was called Laugh for the Cure.
Yes, and they did. So, okay, they raised more money this year, significantly more money than last year. And so it got me thinking, like, you know, raising money is a sales process, right? It's not just like, go beg. You're actually getting to someone's emotion.
Right. There has to be a reason.
Right. And so this year they did something differently. The lady who opened it up, she said, all right, we're going to do something we've never done before. I want you to think about the one person that has brought you to this community, that has brought you here tonight. And maybe you have more than one, but I want you to think about your one or your ones. And on the count of three, I want you to call out their name.
Mm-hmm.
And so the visualization of thinking about the person that you're there to support, or maybe it's multiple people, and then actually affirmation of like saying it out loud, we all said a name out loud at the same time,
mm-hmm.
was huge and powerful. And right after that, they asked for donations.
Keep in mind that the sale is made emotionally and then justified logically. And if you have an emotional reason for being someplace, like this cancer thing, you get emotionally involved. It's my daughter.
Right.
And she's passionate about the fact that she has recovered.
Yeah.
And is now cancer free, which is like the biggest blessing that you can get. And but the people who were there were then asked to cough it up.
Yeah, if you donate $2,500, it'll get 15 people this kind of thing. If you donate $1,500, it'll get 12 people this kind of thing.
And
so that's the logical justification. So we started with the emotion, and then they justified everything. Logical.
I thought it was brilliant. And so last year, I think they raised like $120,000, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. This year, they raised over $200,000 for the Charlotte area Susan G. Komen organization.
Pretty amazing. It's one of the top organizations in the country. And Charlotte tends to shine in areas where there's community involvement. Mm-hmm. We're in the top 10 chambers in the country, even though we're the 17th largest city. And, you know, the community tends to get behind things.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people out there that are listening to this show are looking to double their income this year or over the next decade. And we just told you a story about an organization that in one night nearly doubled the amount of donations they received year over year. Yeah.
And they did it with emotion.
Yep.
And that is the root of the process, that if you're a diehard and you're looking to double your sales, dude, get into the emotional side of it and take your slides and throw them away, or send them to the customer the day in advance. But go in there with ideas, compelling ideas that can help the other guy grow.
And I just want to point something out. It wasn't just like a general emotion like, oh, we're here to support breast cancer. It was personal.
Yeah.
And that's what made the biggest impact. That you were actually thinking of your person that you were there for.
And they had stories. They brought out survivors. The woman who was the announcer has a family history of breast cancer. I mean, it was very well done without being maudlin.
Yeah, it was. It was great. All right, so on to the show.
What do you mean?
Well,
we have a show. Yeah.
Jason Dorsey here today.
We do have the great Jason Dorsey. And by confession, I am a friend of his and have been a friend of his for a long time. When he was fledgling in the business, we just hit it off.
I don't believe he was ever fledgling, but keep
going.
Well,
when he was a smart young man, now he's a smart middle-aged.
He's a brilliant person.
Yeah, he's totally brilliant. And he has chosen a niche of understanding the generations and being able to articulate what those generations mean to an employer. Or to each other in a group of people. And man, he can give a talk that just – he knocks it out of the park every single time he steps up to bat. He's batting 1,000. And – but his fee is thousands. And now, you know, everybody's talking about it. Millennials are talking about the what's happening and how they're doing in the world and what they don't want to do and what they do want to do. And now the Generation Z is coming up. And they're different from millennials because they're – and then there's me, I don't know what they call it, the boomers.
Yep.
Yeah. I refer to them as old fuckers, but it's a whole other thing. And like I go to my high school reunion, it's like everyone's kind of dead.
Oh, Jeffrey.
But the bottom
line, not.
The bottom line is we have matured and there's a lot of money there. And the millennials may not have as much saved up money or the same kind of philosophy or – And this guy articulates it in a way that is absolutely on the money.
Well, and the interesting thing is people make all these assumptions based on a millennial or a Gen Z person that they know. And Jason is here today to debunk some of the myths that we have heard and that we often tell ourselves using real data that he has collected and analyzed and studied and put out there through tremendous research.
He is the co-founder of the Center for Generational Kinetics. And he was in the studio live to help us debunk more than a few of the myths that exist about these generations. And to let you know that the kids are going to be all right. Come on, let's welcome the great Jason Dorsey. This morning, we are privileged and we are blessed. We have an actual expert in the studio live with us here on Sell or Die. He is Jason Dorsey. He is the co-founder of the Center for Generational Kinetics. Come on, guys. That is a freaking great name. Jason won the Austin Under 40 Entrepreneur of the Year Award for Education at age 25.
Damn.
One of the youngest winners ever. He is now an advisor to CEOs, venture capitalists, and corporate boards across numerous industries. He is a researcher. He is a keynote speaker. And I promise you, diehards, he's a one of a kind. Please welcome the great Jason Dorsey.
Woohoo! Glad to be here. Hello, diehards. It's an honor to be with you.
If you want to use this as a funeral speech.
Jeffrey. I've actually peaked now. I'm going to leave.
So, Jason, you lead research around generations around the world.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into this?
Totally backwards and unplanned. Basically, I was speaking for CEOs and corporate boards and all these big events. And the CEOs, who are mainly baby boomers, would say, oh, those millennials, they're terrible. Their pants are falling off. They live with their mom. They won't work on their birthday. They quit and they don't tell me. They've been here a week. They want a promotion.
I literally,
right before you arrived, was like, Jeffrey, I think we need a new policy to give everyone off on their birthday.
Yeah. That's what we do at our company because it's easier to predict they're not going to show up. So the CEOs would just kind of bash on millennials. Now, you know, there's obviously more generations people bash on, but millennials were the hot topic. And this was right after I was on 60 Minutes. And so finally I would ask them, well, can I see your data? Like, I just would love to try to understand how bad this problem is. And when I saw their data, I realized it did not match what the CEO of these big companies had just told me. Like, literally, they had just said this is a terrible problem. Millennial retention is awful. And then I look at their data, and actually millennial retention was better than Gen X, you know?
Right.
And what I figured out as we got into it was that the CEOs and all the execs and managers knew a millennial that was entitled and knew a millennial that acted that way. Maybe it was their kid. But at the end of the day, that then represented the whole generation. And I knew that wasn't true as a millennial. There's 83 million of us. And so my wife, who has a PhD, said, you know, the opportunity is to lead original research to demyth generations, like actually search for truth, and not just millennials, but all the generations, millennials, Gen X, boomers, and now Gen Z, and be the source of that truth, even if, and this is the key, even if people don't want to hear it, because a lot of what we find people aren't excited about. But once you know the truth, then you can make decisions. That's what leaders do, even tough decisions.
And so in the millennial world, there has been more books written, there have been more speeches given about how to deal with millennials. Why do you think that this has become such an issue in our lifetime?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a few things. So one are the drivers of it. So what created this sense of millennial entitlement that people all get so upset about is actually parenting. And nobody likes
exactly.
to hear that. And they all get their feathers ruffled. You know, I'm speaking to 1,000 people and they're like, oh, parenting, don't bring that up. You know, but it's actually the greatest driver of all these different things we look at. And the way boomers raised millennials, and you know this, the idea was we want it to be easier.
Present.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We
want to
give them every
boomer.
We
he got here early.
We gave them stuff that we never had.
Mm-hmm.
And we made it easy for them because we had a few bucks. And we want to make sure that if they wanted the bigger set of Legos, they got it. And if they wanted the phone, the new phone, we get them the best model. And don't worry about paying for it. You don't have to go work for it like I did when I was a kid. You know, we walked to school uphill both ways for
carrying
2 miles.
Your book.
Yeah.
Wait, you didn't have backpacks, sir?
No,
we didn't have backpacks. They were invented after you went to school.
He actually carried tablets that were chiseled.
Yeah.
It's amazing. He was there for fire when it came out. The piece, the way we sum it up as behavioral researchers, is that boomers want it to be easier for their children than it was for them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they succeeded. And so they made it easier. Mm-hmm. And what people don't like to hear is that entitlement is 100% a learned behavior. It starts with parenting. It's reinforced in schools, becomes a norm in the generation, and then we bring it to work. And we're like, hey, it's been a month. Ta-da! Where's my promotion? I was here almost every day. And so
that's a
almost every day and almost on time.
Yeah. Well, don't oversell it now.
Okay.
And so what happened is right as this is going on and boomers are getting frustrated and kind of realizing that this is all happening around them and they maybe even created some of this, then you have all these other things like Gen X who's totally annoyed by this conversation, like because nobody's talking about them. And then at the same time, the millennials do have these outrageous expectations. Not all.
And there's lots of them.
There's 83 million, most diverse generation in the United States. We're the largest generation in the workforce. And this is where we get into demything. So, for example, people say millennials aren't working. Oh, this lazy generation, they're entitled, they're not showing up to work. That is totally bunk. We are the number one largest generation in the United States workforce. And even more so, we're the number one generation of managers in America, period. I mean, if you look at us, there we go.
I'm proud now to be a millennial.
Well, and this is a lot of what we have to talk about. In fact, our research, one of our biggest discoveries, you can see all the diagrams on our homepage of our website, we discovered that millennials are splitting into two different generations. And this is a massive discovery, and people are picking it up now all over the world because we figured out we have this kind of what we call a generational dislocation. So you have one part of the generation doing everything they were told they were supposed to do. Right? You told us to go to school. You went to school. You told us to get a job. We got a job. You told us to show up to work. We went to work. Nobody gave us a ribbon. We didn't get a trophy. Jen showed up today and did not get anything, right?
That's bullshit.
Well, I can't speak for you, but I can try to get you something. And then on the flip side, we have the other part of our generation that's struggling to create real-world traction. And as they split, we call one group megalennials because they have an outsized advantage. And the other group, millennials, this is where it gets really wild. And I think you'll appreciate this, Jen. So as the generation splits, for some reason, and we don't know why, we're really trying to figure it out. We have all these PhDs. What we're trying to figure out is around the age of 30, people self-identify or self-select into one part of the generation or the other part of the generation, and they can no longer relate to the other part of their own generation.
Wow.
And in fact, you'll love this. The group most offended by millennials acting entitled at work? Other millennials who do not feel entitled. Because we think the rest of them are giving us a bad reputation. And then our boss hires some entitled millennial and tells us to mentor them. We don't want to mentor them. They're terrible. Right? You hired them. You mentor them. They're your kid. Okay?
You can find lots of them. I think they hang out on the streets of San Francisco and Portland, Oregon.
There we go. Get ready. Oh, watch out. He brought a marker, everybody. It probably has a notepad, too.
I have a pad.
He's so exciting. I mean, the guy, he can do math by hand. It's incredible. Really represents the generation well. So as we started to dig into these myths, we found that millennials were splitting into two. We found that millennials aren't tech savvy, which was a huge deal and changes how people have to sell and market to them.
Really?
Right? Yeah, they're completely not tech savvy. What they actually are is they are tech dependent. And there's a really big difference. They don't know how technology works. They just know they cannot live without it, which changes the user experience, which changes all the expectations all the way through the purchasing pathway, which changes B2B sales, everything. And so when we have to help companies think through this, it comes down to, and you'll appreciate this, how simple can you make it so it just works?
Yeah.
And so that's when we're doing all these tech strategies and speaking, we're trying to help people implement this.
I don't want to know how it works. I just want to know that it works for me and how I need it.
Yeah. And ideally.
And now.
And the younger you go from down to millennials to Gen Z, and I'm happy to talk about all these, they actually expect it to be predictive. So they don't even want to have to select it. They want somebody else, Netflix, to tell them what they should watch next or YouTube to recommend the video. Or if I'm going to save and hit a savings goal, these things should all be recommended, preferably happening in the background. And we did a big global study with a company called WP Engine, amazing company. And what we found out is Gen Z, who's now 23 and under, was the only group willing to give up their anonymity online in order to have a better web experience. So they basically said, I don't even want to have to make choices. I will give you more information. Isn't that ironic? Jeffrey, look, Jeffrey's already backing away like, I don't want them to know anything about me. Right. Oh my gosh, delete the files. And Gen Z's like, have it all. Just make it better for me, right?
Wow.
So all of these things we get to study and some of the things we found, for example, for the first time, technology trends are starting with the youngest and rippling up to the oldest. And it's always been the opposite because it used to be older and affluent would drive it down because they could afford it. Well, now everything's cheap. It's cheap mobile technology. So all of a sudden, you know, millennials use Facebook. Then who goes on Facebook? our parents, right? And then they start looking up their old high school sweetheart.
No longer cool.
Yeah, no, they're all getting off. Like, right. My mom writes in the comments, I love you, hope you're having a great day. It's like terrible, you know? I mean, she uses commas, it totally freaks me out. And so, all these things are happening. And so when we did the research, the idea was, let's separate myth from truth around millennials, this kind of conversation, Gen Z and the others, and then also see how that informs sales and marketing strategies, and also on the HR, the management side, the leadership side, because all these companies now have 3, 4, some of them have 5 generations, and people are not prepared to deal with it. And there's one thing you said, Jeffrey, that's really important. And you said, you know, why do we have to adapt and kind of adjust to millennials? And I think that's part of the problem. Millennials also should be adapting and adjusting to other generations. And this is particularly true in the workforce. In sales, it's not true. In sales, whoever adapts wins, right? That you got to get to the consumer.
Totally.
Right? But totally. On the employment side, millennials should come towards you because you have experience, you have wisdom, you know how to problem. There's all these things you have that we don't have. And frankly, we're all in it together.
Mm-hmm.
Millennials are not as question prone as other generations, I have found. They don't want to ask about something. They want to tell you how they feel about something or what they expect from something. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, that's the thing that pisses me off. Like, I don't want to
– One of the many things.
Well, if they ask a question, it's what's your vacation policy?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't – if you ask me about my vacation policy, what it tells me is you're going to be pissing and moaning if something happens that's not exactly right. I don't want that person here. Mm-hmm. They're a disruptor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I understand why you say that, because you would probably want them to say, well, what else can I do right now to help move the company forward? And
right.
These kind of questions, which could happen theoretically. But the idea is that when we look at these different generations, millennials do go out and they ask questions and things like that. But a lot of times they don't ask it of their boss. And in fact, the group that asks those questions is Gen X. And that's because Gen X doesn't trust anybody.
So wow.
They're the ones that are more questioning. You know, when I finish speaking, Gen X is the only group that comes up to me. You know, thousands of people in these rooms. They're all, you know, cheering, yelling, all this kind of stuff. It's amazing. I love it. And then we get off the stage and somebody in Gen X, always Gen X, you know, kind of this late 40s, early 50s will walk up and they'll say this, Jason, that was pretty good. I didn't think it would be. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see your data.
Yeah. Exactly.
We even had to put slides of how to download our data for free online because they were so questioning.
My goodness.
Where millennials were like, hey, what do you have on video, Jay? And the boomers come up and they're like, do you have any extra handouts?
Right. Exactly.
I want to take them home.
No. Can I have your slides?
Right. Exactly. So you haven't just done one study, because there's like companies out there that have done a study here or there. Mm-hmm. How many studies have you guys done?
Now, more than 40 around the world. Last year, just at one time, I think we had 13 studies going in 6 languages on 4 continents. And we generally.
Oh, no big deal.
I love getting his emails going, we have a new study. Way to go.
Yeah, we live in the data, because as soon as people start saying something, we're like, is it true? And I think that's a healthy place to start. It's just like, is it true? And sometimes it is. And you're like, wow, okay, great. We can build strategies around this. And sometimes it's totally not true. And when we figure that out, then we can go and build on that. So I'll give you an example. When we look at student loan debt in the U.S., which is a big conversation, right? Supposedly 400,000 houses were not purchased because student loan debt in the U.S. and this massive thing. Well, what we found out when we dug into it is what student loan debt was actually affecting more than anything else is it was delaying major life commitments. Marriage, kids, and buying a home. So it was the big driver of all these things, even committing to a company. But one of the hidden drivers, because that's what we study, right? We're behaviorists, the why behind all the data that everybody talks about. One of the hidden drivers was online dating. Because if there's unlimited fish in the sea, it reduces urgency, right?
True.
Other generations used to be like, oh, I don't know if I'll meet somebody like them, you know? And we're like, I'd like somebody 1 inch taller. Swipe.
Exactly.
Wow,
exactly.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Jenny, I'll marry you as soon as I pay my student loan.
Yeah, so that's what we're always trying to figure out. Yeah, and it's fun. And all of our studies include multiple generations. I think people get lulled into the idea of, oh, I just want to study millennials. But that doesn't really help anything, because we need to create what we call generational context. We want to look at across all the generations and be able to put ourselves in the shoes of each of the generations. Why do boomers respond one way to something like Jeffrey did? Why are you asking me for vacation? Right? I know that if depending on the size of the company, I should be able to go online and using any of these tools in your HCM system, get the answer to that. I shouldn't have to ask you. And the
Correct.
Fact that I do just shows there's other stuff going on, right?
Or they're just not tuned in to mm-hmm. finding out the information themselves. Mm-hmm. They'd rather just ask somebody else because it's easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely true.
I want to throw one more thing at you. I have a granddaughter who's 21. That makes her a Z-er, mm-hmm. correct? We had her when she was 12 years old, come in front of Jeff Jarvis, who wrote What Would Google Do?
Mm-hmm.
He was here for a whole weekend. And he said, no one will ever read a newspaper. That was his mm-hmm. tagline. And so I brought my 12-year-old granddaughter and I said, Morgan, have you ever read a newspaper? And she said, why should I? And that answer is reality,
mm-hmm.
and newspapers don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's –
I mean, they're still printing their rags. Yeah.
Well, I think there's truth. If you look around the channel, so a newspaper is a channel for information, there are certain generations that are still accustomed to it.
Yep.
And I think what people forget is it takes a long time to kill off industries. I mean, people think like look at Sears. Sears has been trying to go bankrupt for 10 years. And you know the old expression, how did you go bankrupt? Slowly, then overnight. and so we're certainly seeing that. There are people that still prefer that. Now, clearly the writing is on the wall, but what hasn't changed is the idea people want access to good information. In general, they still want information that's relevant to them, and I would argue local information more so than anything else. And if you look at how people are using social media, unfortunately, and we've done lots of studies on this, that is the conduit for the news. In fact, millennials trust news on social media more than they do on news outlets.
Sometimes that's a little scary, don't you think?
Yeah, well, it's a big echo chamber.
But I think that the challenge that we have right now is that nobody wants yesterday's news.
Mm-hmm.
They want tomorrow's news.
Mm-hmm.
Or they at least want up-to-the-minute
right
news.
Now, yeah.
And you can go on any.com
mm-hmm.
that's a news, you know, pick your political persuasion because they're all pretty much politically motivated. But you can get news up-to-the-minute.
Mm-hmm. You can, except if you want highly localized news, like for your neighborhood, still hard to get, and then very niche news. So if I want information just on whatever millennial research or just on some of these other things, I'm willing to either pay or go through more effort to get those because it's more specific to me. And that's what we're seeing. As you look at this kind of disintermediation of the news industry and it's all being broken up and suddenly everybody's a journalist and like we do a lot of work around influencers, you know, all of a sudden an influencer has more influence than the newspaper. And yet the influencer hasn't done anything other than figured out how to advertise on Instagram and build a following. You know,
hey, you know what? It works.
It totally works.
And they're making millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And not only if how to advertise on Instagram, think about that as a topic.
Mm-hmm.
No one's saying how to advertise in a newspaper
mm-hmm.
because it's one dimensional.
Yeah.
And you can't click here to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't click here to buy now.
Well, and again, because we do so much research around marketing, let's just take your newspaper and your Instagram example. So if I broke those two out and depending on what I was trying to sell, newspapers still might win. If I'm trying to sell annuities or if I'm trying to get somebody into an assisted living home or if there's certain things that are probably I'm going to still have some success.
Mm-hmm.
And arguably, as people flee things, your costs might go down and you might end up being more effective, right? And we've seen this with a lot of social media where Facebook all of a sudden reduces organic reach and now ad spend, you know, costs more to reach more people. All these things happen. So depending on who you're trying to reach, the platform still matters and it matters a lot. But you're absolutely right that when we look at Gen Z, I had this funny, my daughter's 7. And so I was telling her the other day, I was very short growing up. I don't know if y'all know this. I was 4'10" when I was in 10th grade. And so I ended up getting a driver's license, hardship license, so I could drive to work. And I had to sit on phone books. And so I was telling my daughter this. I was like, yeah, you know, I was so short, I had to sit on phone books. And she goes, What's a phone book?
Right.
And I was like, wow, I'm now that old person.
Exactly.
Oh, man, that is hysterical.
Yeah, and I grew up in a small town, so I just sit on a lot of phone books. You know?
They were thin.
But the challenge of that is that as these things change and fade away,
mm-hmm.
new things take over and a lot of people are not willing to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
They want to go back to the old way of doing it.
Well, and there's behavioral reasons for that. And so the behavioral reasons are, one, it's comfortable. Two, it's become normalized for them.
It's right? familiar. Right.
But the part that nobody talks about is it was also successful for them.
Mm.
So it had worked. And they had a pattern in their mind that doing these things actually worked. And it generally worked for a very long time. I'll give you an example. Annual reviews. people say, oh, annual review is so important. Well, our research shows, and we've done this on multiple continents, that millennials and Gen Z need much more frequent feedback than an annual review. Like we always say, if you only give annual reviews, change the name and call them exit interviews because we won't be there.
Interesting.
Yeah. So what we found, for example, is that with millennials, they need about a minute of feedback every 2 weeks. So the irony is they actually need less feedback in total than traditional management styles provide, but they need different feedback. And I'll give you an example, right? Yeah, because I think it's worth doing this. So I would say, hey, Jen, I saw how you stepped in and helped Jeffrey yesterday when we were slammed. Thank you so much. Like, that's it. Stop talking. Don't write anything up. We don't need a whole conversation. We don't need to sit down and close your office door. It's more this check-in feedback is what we call it. But here's why it doesn't happen. Because older generations were taught, and I promise you Jeffrey's going to agree with this, older generations were taught, if your boss is talking to you, you're doing something wrong.
And, a lot of that.
And we were taught, my generation, your generation, if your boss is not talking to you, you're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, frequency means you actually care about us. Now, the irony is the topic in the frequency we tested didn't actually matter. It didn't have to be coaching. It didn't have to be constructive. It didn't have to be positive. It was just the fact that you recognize that I exist. And the difference between millennials now and Gen Z is Gen Z doesn't need the feedback even in person. They're happy to take a text message or some other type of messenger app that just says, hey, saw you did a great job over here. Saw you're working on this. Let me know if you need any help. Like, that's it. And so all of a sudden, the feedback loop is getting much shorter, which is great for organizations because you can develop talent faster. You could see if people need, frankly, extra help. You could figure out who's actually pulling their weight. But again, other generations, this is all like, wow, that's a lot of transparency. That's a lot of these things. But the reality is, to the other part that Jeffrey, you asked right in the very beginning, you said, what are one of the things that caused this? Well, remember, we still had low unemployment and this war for talent. And so if you wanted to get good people, or at least even people, you had to do some things differently. And that was a challenge for many people. So now you've got a group that comes in with bigger expectations. You've got a group, you're trying to recruit them right now. Look at the job market right now. It is incredibly hard to hire people. And yet we still meet companies still
adapt. Well, let's put a dash there, hire good people.
I would argue it's pretty hard to hire anybody. I can go into all these quick service restaurants and they are struggling just to fill
shifts. Well, it's because they're still using the now hiring sign. Wait, honey, let's stop. This could be the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yeah.
They're now hiring.
I used to be a busser at a restaurant. I mean, that's where I got started. And we work a lot in the restaurant space. So I do think there's still good career opportunities there. But I do realize how they reach out is different. And so you're seeing them have to adapt. You need to be able to change shifts by text message. That's a really big deal. They want to be paid sooner than every 2 weeks. They go and they want to be able to communicate with their managers. They want to know, how are you going to develop my talent? Like, these are all real questions that, you know, some may think are unreasonable. But the reality is we have young people today entering the workforce, our data shows this, later than ever before. And even though teenage unemployment is still not ridiculous, what we don't actually talk about is the workforce participation rate among teenagers, which continues to decrease. So unemployment doesn't look terrible, but that's because they're not looking for jobs. But the actual workforce participation. So now you have a group graduating from college if they graduate, but certainly entering the workforce later or with less work experience.
Hey, everybody, this is Gina Tremarco
and Rachel Tipton,
and we are
Women Your Mother Warned You About,
the new podcast that does what?
Makes sales sexy again.
What's this podcast about, Rachel?
It's a blend of best business practices and real life hacks, and it's filled with laughter, random chatter, practical advice, and some serious stuff.
It's not just for women, though, right?
No, it's a blend of best business practices and real life hacks for men and for women.
Listen to us on the Sell or Die Network,
womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com.
Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, and anywhere that you can find podcasts. And
be sure to subscribe, comment, share our podcast, and give us a review. Tune in and listen to
Women Your Mother Warned You About,
the podcast that makes sales sexy again.
You've been warned.
What's up with the whole side hustle thing? Mm-hmm. Have you done research on that?
Yeah, this is a great – this is so good for what y'all do. So we've done several studies about entrepreneurship by generation. In fact, and we find all kinds of interesting things. One study we just released recently found that baby boomers – this was a different study we did with WP Engine. That we found out that baby boomers, more than any generation, wanted to start an online business. Is that not wild?
That is so cool.
Wow.
Like, it totally.
That's because, and let me give you my boomer response to that. We are entrepreneurs at heart. And when we see that there's opportunity inside online that we have never taken advantage of, somebody's going, hey, look at all that money this kid's making. He's a billionaire and he still has acne. I think we could.
You think boomers want to be home more, though, and that's part of it, too?
Yeah. So let me contextualize it. So boomers most wanted to start online businesses. Now, they weren't the group that most wanted to start business in total. The younger you went, the more they wanted to. But boomers also recognized, I don't need to go commit to a lease. I don't need to commit. Like, don't start with a whole bunch of overhead, right? That's mm-hmm. That's the trap. Like, yep. This is definitely a more efficient way to get there. So the younger we went, the more people wanted to own their own business. Millennials were really interesting, though. So millennials said they wanted to own their own business and all this stuff. And we've done several studies on this. However, and this is kind of a trick question, if we asked, do you want to own your own business? Do you intend to start your own business? And then we even gave it a time frame, 2 years, 3 years, anytime in the future, all this stuff. Millennials, until we started surveying Gen Z, millennials were always the top one that said they wanted to do it. And then millennials cheered, yeah, look, we're so entrepreneurial. However, actual business starts by millennials are down compared to previous generations. We are wantrepreneurs.
Ooh.
Right?
Ooh.
Right? We want to do it. But we're not actually willing to. And so it gets really interesting because this is where the side hustle comes in. So there's a big debate, is having a side hustle actually being an entrepreneur? And I don't know the answer. I think it's a pretty good debate. But does driving for Uber make you an entrepreneur? Does having an Etsy store? I mean, we could go through this whole list of degrees. So there's this really interesting conversation. And part of the reason is millennials have struggled with wage stagnation since the Great Recession. But if you look at wage stagnation, rising cost of real estate, and then you look at student loan debt, for example, they've really been squeezed. So there's no way for them to save and get ahead. And they're the first generation to enter adulthood and say there will be no Social Security, for example, in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So they already know there's no government safety net. One of the ironies, because we work in financial services, so much is people go, oh, well, clearly they're going to go out and start saving and investing and doing all this stuff. As behaviorists, that's not true.
Yeah.
Because if you don't think you'll be able to retire, if you think I cannot ever afford to retire, guess what?
You're going to live now.
Exactly.
You don't save for retirement. Right. You don't save for things you consider impossibilities, right?
Right.
So now what I think is really powerful that we should be talking about. So millennials are this huge generation. We're older than most people assume. The average age of millennial in the U.S. is now over the age of 30. Our defining event was 9/11, which tracks differently around the world. You know, we work all over the world speaking and doing research. What we see is that millennials are currently the most consistent generation in the workforce globally, and that's due to cheap mobile technology. It's not the fact they were young.
And they're growing up.
Yeah. Mm.
They're realizing that if they want a house or they want a family, they have to settle down and do something that's constructive in the world.
Well, there's a level of commitment that people realize they have to have because it reduces risk. And the great backstop of millennials actually getting married and doing a lot of these kind of adult things people talk about is the fact that they still want to have kids. And so we predicted that between the ages of 36 and 42, you would start to see the birth rate climb. And it's exactly what's happening because they stayed single for as long as they could.
I'm 35.
And then ew, that's a gross visual. He's like a ew. Ew, stop it. You know, Jeffrey with his shirt off like by the pool is enough, okay? I'm done.
I just took his headphones off.
It just, yeah, that was disturbing. I hope they cut that out.
Oh,
wow.
Man, that's so funny. Oh,
but the, wow.
We were talking about kids.
Okay, let's stop right there.
Yeah, let's go back to.
Let's finish.
So what I was saying is that the 36 to 42-year-olds say they still want to have kids. And as a result, we're seeing them both get married and then have kids sooner because they want to do that. The irony is there's this big donut hole of 20s and 30-somethings not having kids, which is affecting like diaper makers and all these people trying to sell SUVs to them and what have you. So as we look at millennials, big generation, everybody thinks they're broke. However, we outspent every other generation last year. Greatest lifetime value, most likely to refer our friends to a company and particularly to a salesperson that we believe in. So all these great things about this generation, we get a bad rap, but we're doing so many positives. So it's much more complex, which I think is the key. And when you do real research, you start to see that. But then you get to Gen Z, who's the youngest generation, like you were talking about with your daughter. Gen Z is basically the complete opposite of millennials. We've done all these studies on Gen Z. We do longitudinal studies on them, really trying to understand how they view the world. And so we can study them all the way down to 13 all around the world. And we're constantly releasing these. We release all these studies for free on our website. And when we look at Gen Z, what we see is they're the opposite. of millennials. So Gen Z is fiscally pragmatic. This was one of our biggest discoveries. It's been picked up all over the news around the world. Gen Z, in general, are savers. They want a discount. They want a deal. They're driving sales at thrift stores. And a lot of the name brands that you see in the malls, that people say, oh, well, Gen Z doesn't go to the malls. That's what's killing them. That's totally not true. Every one of those mall retailers has a website. Gen Z doesn't want to pay full price, which is a big difference. So they're going after fast fashion, all these different kinds of things. Plus, you're the most photographed generation in the world, in history.
Ever.
Yes.
Probably combined.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll see how the pendulum – yeah, definitely combined. But the trick is, if you go and buy a lot of clothes, think about this. If you're on Instagram or Snapchat every day, you need a pretty big wardrobe, right?
Exactly.
So all of a sudden, you need to go buy things at a better deal.
And Justice is their store because it's cheap.
Mm-hmm. It's a great example. They're very sell-driven.
Or like me, you rent the runway.
Mm-hmm. There you go. It's another good example. So the way we think about it, what our research has shown, we've released all this data. Right now, Gen Z, oldest are 23, 12% of them are already saving for their retirement, which is wild. I mean, these are teenagers. Over 50% of Gen Z said, and this is a real stat. We've done this study a bunch of different ways. If I receive $500, so we asked them, if you unexpectedly receive $500 and you could do anything with it, what would you do, right? Number one thing they would do, save all of it.
Whoa.
Wow.
These people.
Survey says.
Yeah, survey says everybody guesses wrong. Millennials are fascinating. Their second thing they would do was actually pay off debt because they have student loan debt. Ironically, not credit card debt really. So Gen Z's coming up fiscally conservative. They were raised by Gen X parents. And their Gen X parents told them, you will not end up like those millennials.
I want to throw one other thing into the mix. Technology is now driving the generations in a way that it has never driven them before. Our daughter, Gabrielle, going to be 10 years old. She doesn't text anymore. She Snapchat direct message and Instagram direct message, and that's how they communicate. And not only is it acceptable, but she thinks it's faster. And she's only doing it with her intimate friends. So
it's so funny. She'll be like, I called so-and-so, but they didn't answer. And I'm like, oh, well, did you leave a message or did you send a text? She's like, well, I called them on Instagram. I guess I could call them on the real phone. I'm like, what?
Hello.
Yeah. Well, one of our biggest insights, and y'all may have seen this on my TEDx talk, we talk about generational relationships with technology. And our big discovery is every one of us has a natural relationship with technology that is largely driven by our age. But the relationship is invisible until we are forced to interact with someone who has a different relationship with technology. And then what we uncovered is that when we look at technology, this kind of big piece, we use Gen Z as our example, my daughter, when it comes down to technology, this is the key phrase, technology is only new if you remember it the way it was before.
Ooh.
Ooh.
This is kind of core to my new book that's coming out, and I talk about this a lot online on our videos. But, so for her, calling is using Instagram. In the same way for Gen X, having a landline and you would get the longest cord you could and then you would pull the blanket over your head to call your friends. That was their version of Facebook, right? And so like it's totally normalized and you end up skipping, right? So you're able to skip using the mail or skip using email or skip using a phone. My daughter will not talk to you on the phone unless she can see you. Because she has come of age with FaceTime. She's seven. I mean, we walked in, Denise and I walked in the house the other day, and the way our house is situated, we can't see into the kitchen. So we walk in, and this is what we hear. Alexa, what's 12 plus 14?
Yeah.
Alexa, how do you spell rainbow? Alexa, spell rainbow slower. You know, our daughter's 7 years old, and we had this moment.
Amazing.
We were like, okay, what does this mean? You know, so I'm standing there with my wife, and it's like, this is a big parenting, decisive moment. How are we going to respond? I mean, she is using Alexa to do her homework, and we're standing there looking at each other, and I could not have been more proud.
Exactly.
I love that.
And Denise, like, way to go.
Yeah, Denise was used to be a high school principal, was like, Alexa's unplugged.
Okay, sorry, did you have a
question? No, I have a couple more things I want to say, but...
Well, I have a question.
Let me just say this.
Go for it.
You're a behaviorist.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother punished you for misbehaving probably 1,000 times. How do you go from behavior, non-behavior, to behaviorist, where you're studying other people's behavior and you have to base some of it on your own experience rather than all the research, correct?
Yeah, that's a really intuitive question. So everybody brings their lens of the world to research. We're humans. We can't step away from it. So the way that we work through that, besides using real rigor in our studies, which is very important. I mean, not only are they statistically accurate and weighted against some benchmark, could be the U.S. Census, could be some other group. What we also do is have diversity on our teams. And then we do a lot of testing to make sure, for example, our questions aren't biased, that everybody can answer and understand them. It's really important to point that out. So when we're doing studies that include 13-year-olds, people mess this up all the time. You have to be able to ask the question in a way that a 13-year-old can accurately read, understand, and then answer. And you can't ask them about things they don't know. You know, and so we're very sensitive. We go through all this rigor. But part of what happens, the way I got into this, is I was seeing all this data. And one of my big – y'all heard me talk about this on my soapbox. All these people are running around talking about real-time data. Real-time data, real-time data, real-time data. And so then I have to follow them at all these data conferences and stand up and say – there is no such thing on Earth called real-time data. It doesn't exist. All data that every single person stood up here and said is tracking data. It's an event that has already happened in the past. Sales went up, sales went down. They did this with their mouse. They did that. Like whatever it is. We can go through this whole long thing. And then they're making an assumption into the future to try to figure out what that means. But it's all backwards looking. So the way I describe real-time data and tracking data in general is it's like trying to drive your car forward but only looking in the rearview mirror. And that's how all these executives make their decision because that's how they get data presented to them because that's kind of customary. So for us, I don't just want to know what they did, which is what tracking data is. I want to know why they did it because if I can figure out why, I can change their entire pathway. But I got to be able to step back into the why. And a lot of times in our research, people that we're studying don't even know what their why is. So we do quantitative research, we do qualitative research, and we do behavioral design. And so part of behavioral design is behavioral economics and really watching how people interact with the world around them. So they couldn't even self-report what we're seeing because they don't know they're doing it.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's so interesting.
Well, on that note, this has been amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on our show. We're going to put your website in the show notes.
Great.
And just this has been awesome. Thank you. That was an incredible, I mean, like,
yeah, that was deep.
So incredible. Session with Jason Dorsey. There's lots to talk about. There's lots to digest. There's lots to go over. But before we do, let's get to a 5-star review.
That's right. This one comes from Donald. Donald writes, listening to these podcasts is like sitting with them and their guest in their living room, having a glass of wine and listening in on the conversation. It's casual, unfiltered, stimulating, entertaining, and informative. Thank you, Donald. And to all listeners out there, all 5-star reviews get read on Sell or Die. So go to iTunes and submit yours today.
I love that.
Now, when you're listening to Jason Dorsey, I think that there is always the sort of attention-grabbing, thought-provoking statement that he'll make about a generation, and you think about it, and you're like nodding your head the entire time. He was talking about millennials need feedback once every week or two, and you go, "Oh, that's a nice insight." You know, that's solid. Now, I believe that we need insight as well. Oh, you're a millennial, aren't you? So I try to give you feedback as much as I possibly can.
Okay, thank you.
No,
honey.
You actually seek it.
I do seek it. I want feedback. I love feedback. And I've had bosses in the past that have given me feedback almost daily. And then I've had bosses in the past that really didn't give me any feedback unless I did something wrong.
That's the best feedback in that case is no feedback.
Right. So I knew when I wasn't getting any feedback, he must be really happy with me, especially when he was stealing my work. But that's besides the point.
But people want to adjust, and they adjust based on feedback. We have people in our studio that give us feedback every time we do a podcast.
Yes, and we seek it. Like literally, when the episode is over, I go, okay, Doug, give us feedback.
Yeah.
I want the good, the bad, the ugly, because that's how we get better. If you listen to our very first episode, Well, don't. Please,
it blew.
Please don't. Right. But if you do, okay, we are different now than we were then because of the feedback and because we're open to it.
But here's the deal. Doug and Nada, who are listening to the show as well as producing the show, have an insight about what we're saying and what we're doing because they are not necessarily a participant.
Mm-hmm.
So they can see a bigger picture, or they can get a better feel for what we're doing. And if you're a millennial, you want feedback. According to Jason, I'm going to take his word for it. But if you're a boss, if you're a diehard boss, you want to give your people positive feedback.
But yes, and I think it's so interesting because most big companies right now today, if you think about it, are not run based on this data that Jason is collecting. They're run on the ways that they've always been run. Okay, they do the things for the most part. Maybe they adapt a little bit here and there, but they do the things for the most part that they've always done. So what I mean by that is if you go to a big corporation, you're going to get an annual review. And if you're lucky, you may even get a six-month review. Okay, and you may have to create a self-evaluation and goals and all that. But what Jason is saying is we actually researched this, and this is not what's going to help your people, if they're millennials, grow and prosper and create the best work for you in the best way. And so if you want your people to do best, you have to give them the tools that they need, or in this case, the feedback they need to do best. So now I literally am, for all of our employees out there who are listening to this, I literally have a tracking chart. And I am going to make sure that I am giving every single one of our team members, our family team members, feedback every 2 weeks.
There's an insight also that Jason did not talk about, and that is that when you give someone feedback, it means you've taken an interest in them. And you're sincerely giving them what you believe will help them, as long as it's – even if it's negative, you have to present it in a positive way. Like, this is what I think will help you the most. Oh,
right.
It'll help me? And then you
right.
can go – but it defines and depicts interest.
But it was interesting also that they don't need formal feedback. So it doesn't have to be this, okay, let's sit down and review how you're doing. Just – it could be a text message.
Yeah, but Jason also talks about the technology and how it's being learned by the newest generation coming up as opposed to how I learned stuff. Like new things came out and I decided to pay attention and adapt or adopt. But people of my in my era, half of them can't turn on their laptop.
Yeah, but what
they don't
said,
want to.
What he said was real surprising to me, which is that the younger generation doesn't actually want to understand how things work, like in terms of technology. They just want it to work. And that was really interesting to me because we all assume that they know, or not all of us, but most of us assume that young people know how these things work.
Well, they certainly adopt them right away. I mean, you look at little 9-year-old Gabrielle. She doesn't really care how the iPhone works, but she can put it in her hand, cradle it, and learn anything on it in about 2 seconds.
Well, all of us are growing up in a world now where impediments and obstacles are more and more being taken away by automation. And so, yeah, when things don't work, when there are artificial impediments placed upon us by management, that can be very frustrating. I think as a manager and as someone that is selling a product to a client, thinking about how if that product is actually going to work, the outcome is just extremely important these days when more and more companies are saying, yeah, we can do it and we can make it easy on you.
I want to throw something else into the mix. You see them scooters going down the street?
Ugh, yes.
So you're talking about so some cities don't have this, but there are cities with these e-scooters that you use an app on your phone and then you're off and running.
Do you ever use them, Doug?
Sure.
Nada, you use them? No? That's a no. So not, and Jen?
Well, I tried one once. So I almost okay,
but
drove into
but here's the deal.
Train.
It gets you there quicker. And the kids that use those scooters, they're looking to get someplace quicker. Even at work, they want to get to a quicker solution. They want to get to a quicker answer. And when it doesn't happen at work, they go, well, shit, the scooter works. Why didn't the boss work?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't this happening as fast as it possibly can? They're just looking for a shortcut.
But yeah, okay, that's fair. I think all too often, though, we hear managers who are older saying, oh, those millennials, they don't know how to work. They don't know how to show up. They don't know how to do this. They don't know how to do that.
Right,
and they're blaming. Oh. And they're blaming. And so just like in sales, if you're managing a team, take responsibility instead of blame and figure out a better way to manage them. Okay, they might not be doing the things you want them to do, but that may be because there's a gap in how you're communicating with them. That may be there's a gap in how you're trying to manage them effectively. And so figure out, you know, we were talking to Jason and he's like, we know people don't like to go to work on their birthdays. So we just gave them all off on their birthday. Well, there you go. Okay, company holiday. There's things you need to do to adapt to the new people in the workforce.
My vision has always been the younger person will not respect the older person who may be his or her boss if they're not as technologically advanced as they are.
Mm.
And I think that that is something that I've presented to audiences, and they agree. They agree that they cannot keep up with that young person's technical capability, whether it's social media or just working a device, and I think they need to.
I don't know, Jeffrey. You keep up pretty well, honey.
I know I do, but there's a lot of bosses that don't, and that's the deal.
Got it.
So diehards, if you're out there and you're looking to be a better leader, whether you're boss or not, to be a better leader, then you have to be best, and not just best at talking, best at doing.
So we've talked a lot about managing millennials, but coming up next week, we're going to have Jason back on the show.
Oh, cool.
On a Sell or Die Extra to talk about the buying habits of millennials.
Yes, yes. You guys, we were in the studio until the very last second. You were late for a conference call, which you're never done. Like, literally, we were here until we couldn't stop. We loved having Jason on our show. I'm telling you, this is one of my favorite episodes. So make sure you tune back in for that Sell or Die Extra because Jason freaking rocks.
And on Thursday.
Yes,
Thursday. We have Jared Rubio.
Yep.
And Jared has been my genius at the Mac store for years, and he has resigned. He's now a former genius.
He went from genius to selling to the business department and then eventually resigned because his side hustle makes more than his main hustle.
Ooh. Ooh. So if you're looking for more information on transition into job you love as opposed to job you have, then this episode will give you insight and inspiration. Friday?
Oh, yeah. Best of.
I think that we're taking the best of chunks and doing them better every single week. The numbers of people that are watching, listening have increased significantly. We're very grateful for that. We're very grateful for you diehards. Please show up again next week. I am Jeffrey Gittimer.
And I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm reminding you, get out there and listen to Sell or Die and go sell something, even if your ass falls off.
Diehards. If you love the show, make sure you've subscribed.
And if you've subscribed, make sure you rate us on iTunes or give us a star on Overcast.
And if you've done all of that, tell a friend about the best sales podcast on the planet. Or better yet, tell both your friends.
And if you've done all of that, well, you're a true sell or diehard, and we thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.